Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 129 for December 8th, 2011. Problems, problems, problems. Watch Auto Line After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern or 2400 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Auto Line After Hours in the iTunes Store. Hey, thanks for joining us again, folks. Great to be with you tonight on Auto Line After Hours. Also, great being with you, Peter.
John, another scintillating episode. Is this like episode 3300? I've lost track.
I'm not sure what we're up to now. We should tell everybody, I pull in the parking lot tonight. I'm driving a Chevrolet Sonic. You're driving a Chevrolet Sonic, too. We were talking, not a bad car.
Yeah, you know what? I'm pretty impressed. I've spent a lot of time in a Fiesta, but I have to...
Now, you got the turbo, like I do, right?
Yeah.
Because if you don't have the turbo...
With the shift.
Right.
With the manual.
It's slow. But the thing that impressed me, like we're talking about, is...
So quiet.
Very quiet car, but what I especially like, this has been one of my pet peeves for I don't know how long, decades, that when automakers do small front drive, transverse four-cylinder, subcompact cars, they always gear them in a way so that if you're on expressway at expressway speeds, the engine's screaming a lot.
Yeah, you feel like you're in a tin box, but not this car.
No, this car at 70 miles an hour, you're at like 2,100 RPM, and I don't know of any other small car I've ever driven that can make that claim. Not that I've driven.
It seems pretty impressive, and I like the way it looks.
Yeah.
I think they did a good job in the design, and...
We think Nina did a good job of naming it.
Yes, she did. The naming group in New York.
Right.
It's pretty impressive. I mean, people in the market deserve to give it a look. I mean,
like I said, I'm knocked out that somebody finally listened to me. Of course, they never listened to me at all. They did this on their own, but they finally have got a Top Gear that is such an overdrive that it's pleasant to drive at expressway speeds.
Yeah, yeah. So, my first impressions are really good.
Yeah.
Really like it.
So what's your impression of electric cars, though, man? There's a whole lot that we got to talk about tonight because it looks like there's trouble in River City.
You know, my column was about it this week. It's too bad. I think the Volt is being unfairly,
targeted.
Targeted, crucified.
Now, the House of Representatives, some guy in there says, oh, we got to have hearings.
Yeah, whatever. No, the Volt is still a technological achievement, and they did a fabulous job on the vehicle.
But they've got a... full-blown public relations disaster.
Full-blown public relations disaster. And they're paying the price for being way out front with this extended range electric and the whole thing. And it's too bad because, we live in this 24/7 circus of communication. I mean, there are no breaks. There are no respites from any of it. So, the idea was already, people are saying, well, the Volts catch fire. That's all. They devote about a nanosecond to maybe a lead headline on their web pages or whatever, and that's what they take away.
Mm-hmm.
I had a longtime reader of the site. He has a Z06 and a CTS-V, and he and his wife just got a Volt. And she took it to work, and they were about to get in it, and the woman she was going out to lunch with said, well, are you sure we should take the Volt? Because they catch fire. And she was just like...
Yeah.
That was like 5 minutes into it,
Right.
5 minutes into the news. I don't know what's going to happen. I think GM will survive it, and I think the Volt will survive it. But the bigger issue is the electric cars themselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, here we have politicians in Northern California and in Washington shoving this stuff down the American consumer's throat. And still, they are a niche product for a select few people who either are gung-ho green and want to embrace it, and that's going to be it, or it suits their needs as a second or third or fourth vehicle. But this thing, this idea in Washington that we're all going to be electrified by 2020 is just complete BS.
Well, I think it's going to be a rude awakening for those who think that electric cars are just going to catch on and everyone's going to buy them. And that's the public perception. When I tell folks out there that, you know, hybrids only account for 2% of all car sales, they're flabbergasted. They don't know this, and they think that, no, everyone's buying hybrids, right? And besides, they probably told the pollsters themselves they were going to consider buying one and pay more for it because that's what they want. And as we've talked about here, watch what people do. Don't listen to what they say they're going to do.
Exactly, yeah.
But you're right. This issue of electric cars and where it's going to go is I think we're on the precipice right now because the California Air Resources Board just came out with more stuff trying to shove more people into these electrics. And the dealers out in California are the ones who are really starting to get worried because they're the realists. They know you're not going to have hordes come out to the showrooms to buy these electrics. And if they don't sell them, they're not allowed to sell everything else that they want to be able to do.
Well, I mean, eventually, I think I have to believe that people in California are going to rise up and do something about what's going on out there.
I don't think so. And if they do, it's going to be too late. All this stuff's going to be tooled up. It's going to be in the showrooms. It's going to have been built. And car companies and their suppliers and ultimately the taxpayers are going to take a bath.
Well, then the state will go out of business permanently, you know? And, you know, we'll just go out there for the Rose Bowl and a couple races a year and the Oscars, and that'll be it.
Maybe the L.A. Auto Show.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe. But
although the buzz on the L.A. Auto Show is it's losing steam.
Yeah, I would say so.
I mean, you know.
I would say so. I mean, no concept cars, no new concept cars. There were a couple of ones that we had seen before. You know, I would agree. We don't need to go down that. Because Aptera, that's another electric that just went belly
up
this week.
A friend of ours, Paul Wilbur, who gave it more than the college try. And, you know, the Jetson, I call it the Jetson-esque three-wheeler car they had wasn't going to sustain the company, so they were in the process of developing a midsize car, ran out of funding. Great quote from Paul Wilbur, which was our AE quote of the week. He said, a couple of years ago, there were a lot of people who thought the automobile industry is easy. It isn't. Amen, Paul.
Amen. Well, Paul knew that, you know, having been at, what, Chrysler and then...
ASC. Right. I mean, he had, you know, real skills, and he assembled a team, and they got a lot of publicity for the Aptera because it was Jetson-esque. I mean, and people said, wow, that's cool, you know. Electric.
Well, you know, another thing that I think hurt them is that photovoltaic company, Solyndra, going belly up.
Yeah.
Big, big, big embarrassment to the Obama administration that had poured $500 million into it. And now they're scrambling to check everybody who was supposed to get money. And Aptera was one of those who was supposed to get a Department of Energy loan.
Yeah,
by the way, Ford, I don't think, has gotten their money. And I don't think Nissan's gotten all the money that they thought they were going to get out of the feds either.
Yeah.
So, watch what happens now that the government isn't just throwing bucket loads of money at these people. They're going to be in big trouble. And that's what I mean. This EV thing, it's on the precipice.
It could just
south. Crater big time.
Yeah, I agree. So what do you think about... Subaru executives are convinced the new BRZ sports car is going to be a game changer and it will alter their image dramatically. I'm not buying it.
Did the WRX do that?
Yeah, no. I mean,
it did for a while amongst certain cognizant.
Well, hardcore enthusiasts like the junior rally racer shtick, as I wrote about it on the table. I mean, it appeals to a niche group of buyers, and that car will too. Will it change Subaru's purveyor of pet-friendly station wagons for active people image? No, it won't. The enthusiasts who want it will seek it out and get it, but it's not going to alter the overall image.
No, I agree totally. And, you know, it's kind of curious why they would do that kind of a car. Maybe they think that's the direction they should be going in. I think just the opposite. I think Subaru's got the capability and a willing audience to move even more upscale. I don't mean big time, but, you know, they could definitely start moving upscale some.
Absolutely, because, you know, their buyers, you know, occasionally get out of their flip-flops and their wagons and go out on weekends at night, so maybe they'd want a bigger Subaru and with a little more luxury.
Yeah, but a sports car, you know, look, we all love sports cars. We want more of them, but that's because we're crazy enthusiasts, you know. The general public isn't into that thing, and they're not going to sell them in massive numbers.
Yeah.
Now, globally, yeah, they'll put a business plan together to make it. But remember, now they're competing with Toyota to do it, too, so or Scion in this country. So I don't know. Very curious move on both their parts. The one thing I will say is this, watching Subaru and Toyota work together, man, they didn't waste any time. How long was General Motors allied with Subaru or vice versa? And they got, what, a Saab version
Years they were.
I mean, geez, they didn't get much of anything done. A Saab version of the WRX is about what they got out of it. And bang, bang, you know, Subaru and Toyota together are going much faster.
Yeah. Ike just twirled, so that means we have to run our first commercial.
Okay. Yeah, when the dog gets up and walks in a circle, it's time to thank a sponsor. Ben, let's thank our good friends at Bridgestone.
Look at this. Bridgestone's using natural rubber, researching ways to enhance its quality and performance, and making their factories more environmentally friendly, producing products that save on fuel and emissions, and some that can be reused again, and promoting eco-friendly and safety driving campaigns. One team, one planet. Bridgestone.
Toyota's moving, establishing a beachhead in California for Lexus for their global marketing functions, which I think is a precursor of headquartering Lexus in California. My question is, what took them so long? Really?
Well, you know, I think it's unusual for any car company to move headquarters out of its home country somewhere else.
Well, it's a radical step for Toyota, but...
But remember, Infiniti just moved its headquarters to Hong Kong, right?
Yeah.
So...
But Infiniti is like...
Was it Hong Kong or was it Singapore?
I don't know, but they're nowhere here.
Infiniti.
Yeah.
They're nowhere in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, it just hasn't worked anywhere.
So if Toyota can't figure out how to jumpstart Lexus again, they're going to be in trouble.
But I think it's part of this move of get out of Japan, you know, that the Japanese automakers are bailing because the yen is so expensive for them there.
Yeah.
But, you know, usually you'd think that you would move manufacturing stuff out. But that's very interesting that you're moving global marketing to California and maybe the whole headquarters.
Well, they're saying they're just a little beachhead, but I'm sure they're going to move it to California because they've got to get their mojo back in this market, and it might be difficult.
It might be difficult. I mean, Audi, Mercedes, and BMW are on such a roll right now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unreal.
Although Audi announced they're going to do a competitor to the BMW X6. Why? I mean,
right.
I mean, let's talk about a niche vehicle. And how about the Dodge Dart? What do you think of the name?
Well, we talked about that last week, and we were I thought you said Hornet. It was one that you liked.
Hornet was up, and Dart was up. And the big thing a lot of people wrote us, I remember the Dart. It has nothing to do with that.
Right.
I mean, what Sergio and company did is decided, rather than invent a new name which costs fortune.
Minimum $100 million.
Minimum, more like 150. We're going to at least, you know, go to the vault and drag something up that just has some alliteration and name recognition, basically.
I think it's a smart move. It'll be fine. There's enough people out there who will remember the name Dodge Dart. And it, you know, if you go back far enough, had a decent enough reputation. But you're right. The new one's nothing like the old one. And they released some teaser pictures this week. It's sort of got taillights very similar to the Dodge Charger.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little afraid of that. I mean, if it's kind of like a junior Charger, I'm not so sure that's a good thing. I was hoping for something more forward, you know.
Mm-hmm. I'd agree, but, you know, this is Ralph Gilles running Chrysler Design. I got an awful lot of respect for him.
Yes.
I think the car will probably look pretty good on its own, but I agree with you. If they're just trying to make a transverse four-cylinder front-drive car look like a rear-drive Challenger, let's reserve judgment until we see the whole car, you know. In the flesh, as it were.
And then how about Reuters asking Sergio about the launch of the 500, and he said, to be perfectly blunt, the launch was poorly executed because we had a car way earlier than distribution was available. We launched too early. It would have been a better launch in January 2012 than in January 2011. Oh, really? What are these dealers thinking about that when they read this? I mean, they've got to say, well, what are you doing? Why are you saying that? And he refuses to own up the fact that he screwed up. But it wasn't anyone else. It wasn't Laura Suave. It wasn't anyone on his team. It was his plan, his call, his piss-poor decision-making that botched the launch of the 500. And he cost the Fiat dealers millions, a bunch of money. But he's not going to own up to it.
No.
Never going to happen.
That never does happen.
The great Sergio. And then Alex Taylor just wrote a puff piece canonizing Sergio. It's just like, really? Come on, guys.
Well, I'm a great admirer of what Sergio's done. But the story ain't over yet.
So no, it isn't
I'm
over.
I'm very encouraged where Chrysler has gone and is going. But
and let's not forget, most of that was already in place before Sergio got there.
Yeah, but...
I mean, the product plan, the Jeeps.
Where
are they making the money on?
Jeeps. Jeeps and trucks.
That was
already there.
They were way down the road.
I grant you that. And, you know, it's kind of like what we said about electric cars. You know, we got to wait about 4 years to decide or determine, are they really selling well or not? Because we've got to see what happens once they get fully ramped up. They're not fully ramped up. So don't look into the numbers too deeply now. Same goes for Chrysler. They're posting extraordinary gains. But can they keep that going 1, 2, 3, 4 years in a row? If they do, then we'll canonize Sergio.
Yeah.
Hey, jumping topics, though. What do you make of this stuff of the UAW picketing at Hyundai stores and now calling Nissan a human rights violator?
My disgust with the UAW is well documented. I think they're crazy. I think Bob King's got a screw loose. I really do. It's beyond being he's a little weird. I think it's nonsensical stuff now. It doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, you know.
And then they said, we're not going to target any import.
Yeah, after they said at the beginning of the year, we're going to pick a target in 3 months, which came and went. And then they said, once we get through the negotiations, then we're going to announce a target. And then they started this picketing, and they said, well, that doesn't mean Hyundai's a target. And then they came out swinging at Nissan, and they said, but there's not going to be any target, because that's confrontational.
Well, I think, and then you read between the lines, and they think, well, they're going to be invited to take a vote at these plants. I think these manufacturers are so confident that they'll get blown out of the water. I think they're just saying, yeah, go ahead, Bob. Go ahead and take a vote. See what happens.
See what happens.
See how bad your image gets blown up at that point.
That's right. And, you know, they've tried this before. They've made runs at Nissan on two big runs that I can remember myself. Two big, massive, get it out, and they lost badly. And they tried at Honda, which went nowhere. So I think you're right. I think that the workers there really have no interest in
but
the
But isn't that rhetoric? It's just nuts, human rights violators. I mean, tell that to the people in the Nissan plants who are really happy to have a job. Like, where's this coming from?
Well, remember, they said that they were going to draft up this set of rules and say, or guidelines or whatever their terminology for it is. And any automaker that did not follow their rules or their guidelines was going to be slapped with this accusation of being a human rights violator. It's
crazy.
Stupid. It's really stupid. I don't know what their thinking is. I don't know how they think that this is going to make people want to have the union there.
It's not. I mean, it's over. The UAW just doesn't know it yet. Mm-hmm. You know, they refuse to admit that it's over. They've lost the battle. They've lost the war. You know, they may hang on, but they're not going to add members. They're not going to grow.
Well, they will add members.
By default, just because they're showing up when the...
Well, just because GM, Ford, and Chrysler are getting back on their feet and they're going to hire people back.
But that doesn't mean there's momentum for the union.
Well, and it's not going to be enough.
Yeah.
You know, they have something like 110,000 members right now. I think it's up to 115,000 with the new hires back. I remember when Chrysler alone had that. You know, Chrysler alone. And now it's GM, Ford, and Chrysler and the few remaining suppliers that have that many.
Yeah.
So it's not sustainable unless they get the transplants. And we'll see. I mean, they you know, the talk is they'll still go after Volkswagen because that plant that Volkswagen just built in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Because of Volkswagen's relationship with the unions in Germany.
Well, that they're gonna... supposedly the Chattanooga plant is the only Volkswagen plant in the world that is not unionized. So the UAW may want to go in there. But you know what? The workers at the plant, even if they want a union, they may not want the UAW.
Yeah, the workers might just say, nah, no thanks. Because it seems to be a lot of negative baggage whenever you guys hang out. Whenever you guys show up in town, there's bad stories in the paper. There's all kinds of stuff. And, you know, it's true that, you know, most workers are probably going to say, no, you know what? I like my job. Thank you.
So, yeah, I think it's going to be a long, slow, painful, downhill slide for the union. They're not going to go away overnight. And there's going to be plenty of other battles. Remember that no-strike clause comes off at the end of 2014. And you can bet that there's a bunch of those radicals then that are going to want all the concessions back again. I think the next round of negotiations 4 years from now could get real ugly.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Speaking of bad stories, Saab has got to be on its last legs.
Yeah, it's too bad.
I mean, we've been talking about it all year.
For a year.
For a year, but I think it could be any day now.
Any day now, yeah.
And I still say somebody out there, some investigative journalist, has got to really dig into Victor Mueller and Victor Mueller, however you want to pronounce it, and get the background on this guy. I hope it's all legit, but, boy, there's enough weird stuff that's gone on that somebody ought to dig into. How much was he paying himself? Where did the money go that they did get?
Yeah.
Somebody's got to be looking into that. And it may turn out that it's all above board and it's all hunky-dory, and he did, you know, do everything that he could for that company. But when there's this much funny business going on, if the money's there, the money's not there, and these guys are coming in, those guys are not, and someone's got to dig into this. There could be a big story there.
Yeah. Time for another commercial break.
Let's take a commercial break, and then we'll have our guest, Michael Koresh, come on. But, Ben, let's thank our friends at Chevy.
The Chevrolet Cruze is the car that is taking the world by storm. And a key reason is all the equipment that it offers. A driver information center, a USB port, ambient LED backlighting on the dashboard, remote start with a MyLink app, two accessory power outlets, one in front and one in the back for the rear passengers, OnStar turn-by-turn directions free for the first 6 months. Whew, there's just too much to list here. And you can check it all out at Chevrolet.com/cruise.
Well, joining us right now is Michael Koresh from True Delta. Michael, welcome to Out of Line After Hours.
Well, thank you for having me here, John.
So explain, because it's better you do it than I do, explain to the audience what True Delta is all about.
What it's about is just trying to get some better statistics on things like reliability and fuel economy. Mostly reliability is the focus. And I did this, I mean, it's kind of why I guess I got on here, is that you were discussing Consumer Reports a few weeks ago. And I guess back when I was in graduate school, I wanted better statistics than I saw them pushing out. So and the main things I tried to fix were, I thought there was a big problem having an annual survey, because people can't remember things that happened more than a few weeks ago very well. So if you send them out a survey once a year and say what happened over the past year, they forget a lot of stuff. And they were also asking them just to report problems you considered serious. And I think a lot of people say that Consumer Reports is biased, and I've actually never felt that they were themselves biased. The problem is that they put their question out there saying, report problems you consider serious, and some people think that a rattle's serious because, well, whatever reason, but they have a lot of rattles reported. At the same time, some people decide not to report a transmission because, well, they paid for it under warranty and I had a loaner, so it really wasn't any trouble. And so you have such wide variation, it puts a lot of noise in their data. So I just wanted to get a survey that, first of all, updated 4 times a year very promptly. So like right now, we're 6 months ahead of them, and another month from now, I'm going to start looking at data that's 9 months ahead of them. And also ask a question in an objective manner if possible, saying, report anything you had to go to the shop for, taking the subjectivity out of it. If it went to the shop, you report it, we're going to count it. That way we don't have to worry about whether this person's reporting a rattle while that person's not reporting a transmission. And the two things kind of blend together with them, too, because if you have a year window and you ask what you considered serious, now if it happened a year ago, it seems a lot less serious than if it happened last week. So you get a lot of that. I mean, I don't, you know, I remember a transmission problem we had in my wife's car a few years back. At the time, I thought it was awful. Now I'm like, you know, whatever. And so, you know, you get too much of a time factor. So that's what we tried to do. And so, like, last month we came, you know, right now our stats go through the end of September, which is very much real-time data. And that really affects you most. I don't know if you, like you brought up the, I think the Consumer Reports kind of dinged the new Ford Focus and the Chevrolet Cruze. And how that will happen in their results with a April survey is they're surveying the very first cars off the line based essentially on any initial problems they might have. And I can look at my data from last spring and say, yeah, both of those cars were having some problems then. The thing is, now that I have 6 more months of data, I can see that those problems aren't present in the more recently produced cars, or even in those first cars now that they've had the initial problems taken care of. And so that's why I see the value in this, is you can actually see this improvement very quickly when you have a quarterly update, while Consumer Reports won't be able to report that these cars have improved till next October.
Yeah, that's a great point. My problem with Consumer Reports has always been that their survey is of their magazine subscribers. So you're already starting off with a subset of the car buying public. And it's not random. You're getting a good survey of people who like to fill out surveys, which is not necessarily indicative of the car buying public. And that's the big issue I've had, that I didn't think that any statistician worth his or her salt would subscribe to that kind of methodology.
Well, that would be me too then, because I don't have a random survey either, a random sample either. But I mean, that is the number one criticism people will level at me, is that I don't have a random sample either. I'm seeing, frankly,
but
I'm
you're going
I'm
out after myself. Anybody, right?
Anybody, but
so
I mean,
you're not just going after the specific. Yeah. Subscribers to a specific magazine.
You don't, but I don't think they would have trouble with that if they didn't word the question the way they do. The problem is if you have a specific group of people, then you tell them to report problems you considered serious. That you considered serious means you can be biased in your responses honestly, because you honestly did not consider it a serious problem because of what your biases are. So you've been hearing, maybe you've been hearing a certain brand is really good all these years. So when it has a problem, it doesn't seem as serious. Well, if another brand, which you were kind of nervous about to buy anyway, because you've heard, you know, you've been reading all these years that that's a spotty reliability. And then it has a fairly minor problem. Then suddenly you've got all these fears welling up, and so it seems serious. So those two things might combine. I don't think, the thing is, no one truly has a random sample. J.D. Power will go out there and randomly sample people, but only about 20-25% of the people respond. So then you still have to wonder, of the people who respond, do you still have a random sample? Or is there some bias involved in who responds to the survey and who doesn't? You still have your survey takers.
Well, but here's another thing, is every year Consumer Reports publishes their list of which car companies or cars are good and which are not. And I'll pick on Chrysler. They've dominated the bottom of the list for years. For years they've dominated the bottom of the list. So let's say I'm a Consumer Reports subscriber. I'm thinking of buying a car. So I go and I look in Consumer Reports and I see, oh, Chrysler's bad. In fact, if I go back several years, I find that they're always bad.
Yeah.
Now, why would that kind of person go out and buy a Chrysler or any other car that's at the bottom of the list?
They will have trouble getting a large enough sample for the cars they don't recommend for that reason. I mean, The other thing which I didn't mention, even though I went on for a little bit earlier, is that I also want to get some real numbers out there. The thing that we do at True Delta is I put the actual repair frequency. This car had 60 repairs per 100 cars per year last year. With Consumer Reports, you're just looking at a black and red dot. You don't know what the difference is between them. And the thing that no one really knows, because frankly, they don't really try to put this out. And if you ask them, they will get back to you later, is that their average problem rate is around 16-18% for like a year or two, like a 2011-2010 car, that range. It's in the high teens. And then their range is 20% on each side of that for average. 20% of 16% is only like 3%. You're talking about one problem for every 30 cars tends to be the difference in those dots for a newer car. And so when a car is worse than average, that could mean it has one extra problem for every 10 cars compared to a car that's better than average. And people don't realize they're making decisions based on such a small difference. That's kind of where I came up with this True Delta name. Delta meaning difference. I was trying to make it clearer how small these differences often are. It's even, my sister was buying a car herself a few years ago. She's like, I don't think I believe your results because all the cars I'm looking at are pretty similar. I'm like, that's because they all are pretty similar. And if you try to make the differences small enough between your different ratings, you can pretend they're bigger than they are. And so that's kind of what you're getting at with the Chryslers. You know, it doesn't take a whole lot of extra problems to suddenly get at least a half black dot or even a full black dot in their ratings. Huh. And they don't tell you the actual number, so you don't really know how bad it is.
Ford's gotten dinged this year because of my Ford Touch. I mean, a year ago, Consumer Reports was singing Ford's praises. Now they've dropped like 20 spots on their survey. Yeah. Does your research show that kind
of? It won't because of what I counted. You got to look at, with any survey, mine, anybody else's, you want to look and see what the question is that's being asked. Because unless you know what the question is, you don't really know how to evaluate the answer. And it's sounding like, with Consumer Reports, they're suffering from the same sort of thing that J.D. Power will do. J.D. Power takes two very different things, lumps them together, gives you a single number. They lump together an actual defect you take to the shop to get a repair on with, oh, this thing annoys me. And so if you feel that your My Ford Touch is really seriously annoying you, that's a serious problem. You can report it. I'm only counting, just trying to get objective, trying to take some variation from owner to owner out of it. If it goes to the shop and they fix it, and it's actually, I also exclude free software fixes, because I think cars are getting to the point where your computer is, you know, every time you go on your computer these days, they're downloading some software update. Are you going to count each one of those as a repair? So I don't. If you're looking only at mechanical repairs, you know, your Fords aren't going to get dinged as much. Although the dual clutch transmission had a few little issues there early on.
Is that just the consumer not being used to that kind of transmission, or is it what I believe, the way Ford calibrated how it shifts? Or is it a problem with the transmission?
I think it's more the consumers. Consumers are used to the old school transmissions, which were seamless, smooth, and they perceive that the double clutch transmissions, especially, you know, and in stop and go traffic. Uh-huh. That's what I kept hearing. It's like, oh, well, there's something wrong. No, not really. But it's just a different way to go. And they complain loudly.
A few of them had some serious, it was a fairly small percentage. Some of them had really real mechanical problems. Actually, a more common one with the Fiesta is that it was only tangentially related to the transmission, is that they had a grounding strap that was on a painted surface, and it wasn't making good enough contact, so often the transmission would refuse to go in gear.
And that caused
some of this. And
we had a viewer call us on that a couple of weeks ago, saying he couldn't get it into gear, and I didn't understand what that was about. So that explains it.
The fix is to remove the ground, remove the paint from under it, and reattach the ground. And I think they also, there's a software update paired with it, too. That was what was causing a lot of that. And when they the thing that really concerns me a little bit about things like that, and like Audi has had a problem with water pumps, plastic water pumps that were self-destructing in a lot of their V6s, including, I don't know if you had that in your S4 or not. Mm-hmm. And BMW had their high pressure fuel and their fuel pump failures, which you probably all heard about. All these things are happening in cars that are like a year old. Why weren't these things caught in development? I don't know if it's because development is so rushed these days that they're letting these things get through that you'd think would be caught.
Or, I'll give you another theory. What the engineers tested at the proving grounds and what the suppliers actually sent them in production may not be exactly the same.
Yeah.
Or sometimes, too, there's a supplier will change something to cut cost, or somebody, maybe not even a supplier, inside will make a change. And today, with everything so intricately intertwined electronically, you make one small change someplace, it can show up somewhere else.
I think that definitely happens. And then if you're a German manufacturer, the thing you usually blame is American gasoline for being too poor in quality. That's the one I see over and over. I think that's the blame for the BMW fuel injectors. I had someone take an Audi in the sample who, they sent me pictures of this. They had an Audi Q5, so it's not that old. And they had to have the engine pulled out and the exhaust removed to clean out, and he showed me all the black carbon that was removed from his engine on a two or three year old car, and the dealer's explanation was bad American gas. So
yeah, well,
and maybe at the lab they used pure European gas to test it the whole time.
Actually, U.S. gas right now is about as clean as European. We used to have very high levels of sulfur in our gasoline, and I would have bought those arguments back then, but. In fact, right now we have lower levels of sulfur in both our gasoline and diesel. So I don't buy that argument.
Well, it means it's not their fault. And as you guys were discussing earlier, everyone's trying to find a reason why something's not their fault. So.
That's right. And I just wonder if they have those kinds of problems in places like Mexico and China and other places. Or the fuel isn't as clean as it is in the U.S.
It's possible. I mean, the thing is that the United States, and I'm just a small player in this, I mean, the U.S. has the world's most finely tuned automobile reliability industry. I mean, with Consumer Reports and J.D. Power, and the rest of the world doesn't seem to even, you know, car problems are car problems. They fix it, they move on. In the United States, people are far more concerned than they are elsewhere in the world about, am I going to have to go to the dealer to get it fixed or not?
Mm-hmm. Hey, it's probably a good place to take another sponsor break and then come back and get to some of our viewers' questions. Ben, let's give some thanks to our friends at Hyundai for sponsoring this show.
Hyundai is known for the great value that it offers, but let's not forget about the technology. The Hyundai Sonata is the first vehicle in its segment with standard integrated Bluetooth hands-free phone. It's the first vehicle in its segment with factory-installed HD radio technology with multicasting. And it's the first vehicle in its segment with XM Nav traffic and XM data services. That, plus NHTSA's 5-star overall crash test rating and the IIHS top safety pick, explain why the Sonata is selling so well. And you can check it all out at HyundaiSonata.com.
Okay. Well, let's get to those questions. Let's go to Rapid Fire Ben. Bring it on. Okay. Unsprung wants to know, is the Dart cruise-sized? Same size as the Chevy Cruise?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, there you go. DC Auto Geek wants to know, why did GM block the sale of Saab?
Well, I think that was pretty clear cut. They had a lot of technology invested in and that they owned, and especially in that all-wheel drive system, and they weren't just ready to hand it over to the Chinese, just, you know.
Right, because remember, we were talking about Victor Mueller earlier. He was ready to sell Saab lock, stock, and barrel to Youngman, Lotus, and Pengda. And GM was going to go along with the deal as long as Saab retained majority or even a significant minority ownership in the new company. And when it was all going to the Chinese, that's when General Motors said, no way, we're not giving this stuff away.
Yeah.
Prehistoric says, care to comment on the supercar pileup in Japan, Ferraris and such?
Well, you know, that kind of stuff happens. It just, you know, in the 24-hour communication circus we live in, it was like front page. Story.
Around the world. I mean, that made the news around the world.
And come on, I saw a 355 beater Ferrari in there. I mean, it's... You know, yeah, they were Ferraris, but so what? You know?
How did someone lose control of that kind of car on a straight highway is my question.
I think there was a pass made, and they lost it.
I think they were traveling in a pack. It was probably raining, I think. They were going at a high rate of speed, and here's a bunch of guys who probably don't get to drive that fast, especially not in the rain, and kaboomo. Prehistoric goes on to say, he's got no sympathy for those drivers, but they hit a Prius. Arr, he says. So now we know where the prehistoric name comes from. Mm-hmm. Okay, Mike D. White says, Chrysler's planning a 9-speed transmission. How many gears is too many?
Who knows? I mean, it'll go until I don't know what.
Hyundai's got a 10-speed under development, and I think ZF is doing a 9-speed. That's a ZF 9-speed, and they're doing a 10-speed rear-wheel drive.
I interviewed the guys at ZF at the Frankfurt Auto Show this year, and they said 10 speeds. They said that's all you got to go to. But I remember years ago when a Mercedes transmission guy said, you don't need any more than six. So it's the answer is whatever the marketing guys think they can sell. That's the answer.
Until it hunts around too much and they have to field too much warranty.
Dan says, I saw the new Caddy XTS at the LA Auto Show. Very underwhelming. Compared to the Audi products, it does not stand a chance. Not close to the striking good looks of the CTS. Woo, we're going to talk about this. Together with the new Malibu, which I found worse than the outgoing model, these are signs that GM is going back to the bad old days. What do you guys think?
I don't think so. I think the XTS is going to appeal exactly who they're aiming at. They may talk about, well, we're going to go after BMW and Audi. They're not. They're going to get American buyers who want large luxury car. Mm-hmm. That looks pretty decent. And I think the XTS, by the way, will look much better on the road than it does under the lights of the auto show.
The other thing, too, is I had two of the designers take me around the inside of the car. There's a lot of subtlety in that design.
Yeah.
That when you just glance at it, my eyes certainly didn't pick up on it. There's a lot more detail into it. I would agree with him, though, is... It's not going to knock Audi or Mercedes.
Well, no, of course it isn't. I mean, but when GM says that, you just got to say, yeah, right, and move on, because it's not going to happen.
Right.
Not with that car. Now, when they do the ultra, you know, full-size, super luxury Cadillac, we'll see.
The CL concept.
Yeah, they won't have any excuses.
No.
So if that doesn't compete, then they'll never compete. But the XTS, there's no way it's going to compete with
them. Well, I think the bigger question is, I mean, they're trying to do like Lexus. Can you really go both ways? They're trying to do both this traditional luxury market and the sports sedan market. And Lexus has been trying without success to do that for, at least 10 years now? And
that's
doing the same thing.
I mean, because the Germans have pulled it off. They can do very conservative sedans. They can do sport coupes, and then they can do M and AMG and S, and they can pull it off. But Lexus has not.
Well, Lexus is trying to field like two separate groups of cars. You have the ES and the LS, which are their luxury cars, and the RX, and then they're trying to sell you the IS and the GS as performance cars. Mm-hmm. And with Audi or BMW, Mercedes, they have one group of cars, which they have different trim variants on, not two separate groups of models. And Cadillac's going to be looking at SRX and STS. Versus the, I guess, CTS.
Right. No, great point. Malibu, I kind of agree. I don't think it's worse than the outgoing car, but it's, wait till that Ford Fusion comes out. That's going to shock GM into wishing that it had gone farther with the Malibu.
Oh, the Fusion is going to redefine the segment flat out.
And yet the Cruze is outselling the Focus, so.
Yeah, but they are having manufacturing problems with the Focus.
They were.
Right?
They were.
Having instrument panel problems making that. Okay, DC Auto Geek says, Toyota owns a share of Subaru, don't they? Yeah, they do.
More than a share.
They have.
A little bit more than a.
I'm trying to remember the exact amount. Somehow my mind says 14%.
Did they end up with GM's share? That's about what GM had at one point.
Yeah, maybe that's why I'm thinking of that number. Yeah. But anyway, Toyota does have a chunk of Subaru.
Yeah, and so and Nissan might have at some point. They were closely aligned with Nissan at one point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Rich Olympio says, does the hybrids are 2% of sales include mild hybrids like the GM e-Assist? e-Assist seems like a good compromise, and it is. No, that number does not include e-Assist. But remember, e-Assist just hit the market. I don't know I've seen any sales numbers on it, but it's going to be very small, especially compared to all the other hybrids out there.
Yeah, you might as well include it because it's not going to be a different number either way by a large amount.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we've got a phone call here. Ben, let's bring in the first phoner.
Hi, this is Rafib. I'm calling from Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Baton Rouge.
On the December 7th of AutoLine Daily, John mentioned Chinese cars and how the Chinese public actually prefer foreign brands. Now, here in the U.S., just a few years ago, Hyundai, Kia were kind of in the same position. For example, I didn't like their styling, and I didn't think they were very reliable. But fast forward to today, and Hyundai, Kia makes some of the most competitive cars in the business. And we know that it took a lot of spending, a lot of cash for them to get where they are today. My question to you guys is, will the Chinese brands get there? Do they have the same, you know, large sums of cash to get there? Or is it that they're too tightly controlled by the Chinese government and that's kind of slowing them down from making great cars? Thank you.
Great question. Really good question. You got to be careful. There's really two types of Chinese car companies. Some that are pretty much government entities, like you've probably heard of Shanghai GM, Shanghai Automotive Industry Corporation, or a First Automobile Works, or Beijing Auto Industry Corporation. Those are government entities, largely run by the cities where you hear the names from, like Beijing or Shanghai. And then you have independent companies like BYD and Chery and what's the other one that I'm thinking of that starts with a C?
Geely,
exactly.
Geely.
But those guys pretty much can do what they want, and they're probably going to be the first ones that want to come in the U.S. market. But they'll have sales to begin with because their prices are almost undoubtedly going to be the cheapest on the market. But like the caller just said, people forget how long it took Hyundai to get it turned around. I think they first came to the U.S. market in 1986, and they really didn't turn into a serious car company here until about 2002, 2003. I think the Chinese might be able to do it faster, but so far they have not been able to build brands of any sort that people really aspire to.
Well, look at any other industry. I mean, how's it going in any other industry? I mean, Korea has a number of very strong companies in different industries at this point.
They really do.
I mean, Samsung, where were they 10 years ago?
Mm-hmm. Hey, Ben, we got another phoner. Let's bring that in.
Hey, John. Dan from Durham, North Carolina. I just called to see if you guys have gotten any inside skinny on whether the new Dodge Hornet is going to be a muscle-bound SRT4 base. In other words, for Ralph Gilles to just turn into a beast. That would be awesome.
Peter, what do you think?
Thanks a lot. Should they,
bye-bye.
I think they'll just try to get the car out without screwing it up, and then they'll add performance versions as they go.
Down the road.
Yeah.
No, I would agree. I think they're coming out with a 1.8, a 2-liter, and a 2.4, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The smart thing is get the car out there. There's going to be a lot of buzz around it.
They're showing it in Detroit.
4 years into the program, maybe before a refresh. Pop with a performance model.
Oh, I think we'll see a performance model within the first 12 months.
Oh, do you?
Oh, really? That soon?
Yeah, because they'll run out of ideas quickly.
Well, yeah, the arc's not here quite yet.
Especially if it looks like a junior charger, that'll be unfortunate.
Yeah. Isn't it going to be a hatchback, or you think it's going to be a sedan? The one thing I saw said it was going to be an alpha hatch with different ends on it.
Yeah, which would mean it's more like a notchback hatchback, right?
Yeah.
So, sort of sedan-like, but with a hatch is what I would imagine it to
That's
be.
That's what you think it's going to be?
We shall see.
We shall see. Yeah. Chris G. says, I used to have an S10 pickup and would love to have another. The Colorado will be sold here, and I think that's a great move. I think he means the new Colorado. But one thing that we need is a small diesel in that truck. How much of a chance do we have in getting a 2.5-liter or 2.8-liter diesel over here that's offered in Thailand and other countries? Great question. I agree totally with him. That truck would be awesome with a diesel.
Mm.
Stay tuned. I would only say that because of this. GM is going to put a diesel in the Cruise and sell it in the U.S. market. Mm. Mazda is going to be coming over here with a diesel as well. And That could be very interesting. And, you know, diesels in a pickup, I mean, the two just go hand and glove together.
You would think it'd be cost prohibitive, but if they can put one in the Cruise, I guess they can put one in the pickup.
Well, the key is keeping it around a 2-liter displacement.
No.
And then you don't have to, as Bob Lutz used to say, build the small chemical company under the truck to clean up the emissions.
Mm.
If you keep it, you know, turbo, direct injection, common rail, 2-liter, you can pretty much meet the U.S. emission standards without going with selective catalyst reduction. Mm. Let's see, Ben, we got another phoner here. Let's go to that one.
Yeah, John Rook from San Diego. And the electric cars, I mean, how many multi-week power outages have we had in the last year for a variety of reasons, which can't help people's confidence in buying an electric car? And I believe one of your guests a couple months ago mentioned something about it. The power in an electric car is like worth about a week or something like that of your house to power your house. I mean, I'm not sure how you get that much power into a battery pack in 5 minutes. Comments?
Yeah, I agree totally. Rick, you make a great point. When the power goes out and you can't recharge your electric car, you're going to regret the day you bought one.
And besides the fact, until you can go in with an electric car to get a recharge and it's no more time than it takes to fill up your car with gas, it ain't going to fly.
It ain't going to fly. That's right.
People don't have that kind of time.
Right. You know, with a 240 charger, with a Nissan Leaf, for example, you're looking at what? I think about 10 hours to recharge it. That's a long time to sit around waiting. Okay, Nick Diesel says, will the XTS ever come in V-trim, or a big V8, in other words?
Yeah, who knows?
Who knows?
Be more likely to be a turbocharged 6, I would think.
I would say if the XTS sells well, it would be smart for Cadillac to do a V version of it, because even if you only sell 10 to 20% of the line, you can make big money on that 10 to 20%.
I wonder if they do a V. I mean, I would expect them to come out with a turbocharged 6 to go up against the EcoBoost and the Lincoln MKS, but would they call that a V or not?
It's all about performance. You know, we got to get away from the mindset that if it doesn't have a V8, it's not a true performance car. And to me, the real measure is power to weight. That tells the whole story right there.
Well, handling. I mean, the CTS-V is just such a wonderful handling car. I mean, the XTS, no matter what they put in under the hood, is not going to perform that way.
True. That's right. Brian says, so Aptera went out of business this week, and we continue to watch the slow death of Saab. Are there any other companies that you see folding in the near future or should fold? Yeah, I can give you at least one, Mitsubishi. I don't see how Mitsubishi's
going to
survive.
They're not dead yet. I was thinking, but they've survived this far, so I don't think anything can kill them.
Mitsubishi and Suzuki.
And yeah. Well, let's define things. We're talking about the U.S. market now.
Mm.
Because
Suzuki
is like number one in India.
Yeah, they have a reason for being over there. They don't over here.
Right. And Mitsubishi, not at all.
That's a zombie car. I refer to them as a zombie car company because it looks like, and they're not dead yet, so I assume that nothing can kill them.
Right. Isuzu, too, is essentially dead. They're just a medium truck seller in the American market any longer. But who else out there? There's going to be, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of Chinese companies that fold up and go away because they have too many. The rest, I don't know. I think the rest could... I still have big questions about Jaguar and Land Rover. Not so much Land Rover. Jaguar I got big questions about.
They've put a lot of money into it.
They have, and the sales are not there. So, anyway, good question. Brian says, Ford's phasing out the E-Class and replacing it with the Transit. Do you really think that product will work in the American market?
Well, does he know what the European Transit looks like?
I'm assuming he does.
Okay. I think the new one, the contemporary one, is going to do very well.
I don't, and I'll tell you why. Well, let me preface that. Depends how they price it.
Well, yeah.
Because,
it looks light years better.
It does. Well, you know, the Econoline is just a van body on a truck chassis, full stop.
Yeah, it's just a brick.
Oh.
The packaging's not there and the efficiency's not there.
But, you know, an Econoline van starts at $27,000. A Daimler Sprinter starts at almost 10 grand more, $36,000. Yeah. And Sprinter vans, the sales are nowhere. I mean, they sell a couple of thousand a month, I think. And it's all because of the price. Everybody I know who's got a business that needs a van loves the Sprinter and can't afford it. So that's the big question for me about things like the Transit. I think it's what, the Ducato? Is that the big one from Fiat's got a big one, and GM's got a big one too. But well, it's all going to be.
And Nissan, you're forgetting Nissan's new entry.
Oh, and Nissan's too, right. But Nissan's gone the truck chassis with the box on
the
back.
It's
very much like an Econoline or a Chevy Express.
Well, that's what came to my mind. When Ford, what else are they going to buy? And I guess you're right. General Motors and Nissan will still have those traditional vans.
Right. Mitch W. says, for the true Delta guy, does he know anything about the differences between the people who buy cars of various prices? Are we really random?
I haven't collected the demographic data for that. And I think there's some truth to the fact that when you get into your luxury car buyer, your higher-end buyer, they are going to be pickier about some things. I mean, one guy who comes to mind, I knew that who was part of the survey, who traded in a BMW 7 Series because he did not like how the ZF transmission clunked down into first gear as he came to a stop. That last few feet, when it downshifted into the first gear, he could feel it, and he didn't like that. So is that typical of that buyer? Probably not, but it might be somewhat of an indicator.
Mm-hmm. Another question from Mitch W. Is GM willing to kill Opel and let Chevy fill the gap?
No. They're gonna
not
give it,
yet.
Not yet. I'm going to give it one more try.
They're going to give it a heroic try. And woe to everybody at Opel, because it's going to get nasty. They have to take an axe to that operation. There's no two ways around it.
What's Gursky going to do over there?
Well, he's going to have to close plants and lay off people. Look at what General Motors did in the U.S., and that's what they're going to do at Opel.
I find him fascinating just because he's just been a student of the industry for so long, knows so much about it. Now he's actually going to not just going to have to be an analyst, he's going to be a doer.
Now he's got to do it.
So what
and if he does, then we'll say, yep, he is a genius.
Yeah.
Another comment from Nick. He says, I've never driven a DSG. What's so different at low speeds?
They can be a little bulky. It just depends on the car you're in and the setup and the programming.
I would describe it this way, especially if you look at the Fiesta, which has a dry clutch DSG as opposed to a wet clutch. And a wet clutch is just what you think. There's more hydraulics in there and whatnot that can smooth out the shifting. Mm-hmm. With a dry clutch, they tend to, I'm over-exaggerating, but, they tend to slam together. And if you're used to a nice torque converter transmission with very clear step speeds that are very smooth, a DCG or DSG can feel balky, as Peter says.
Porsche feels pretty good, although I guess at low speeds is the weakness for all of them.
The new gearbox, the new PDK, and the new 911 is sensational. It's really good.
Well, again, it's when you get up into that price of car, there's all kinds of things that you can add on electronically to smooth out shifts. You can pull a little bit of spark out to cut the torque momentarily as the plates go together, bring it back on, and a whole bunch of other things that you're not going to do in an inexpensive subcompact car. Just not going to do it. Well, look, we're at the top of the hour here, and probably a good time to wrap this all up. But, Michael, thanks so much for coming on. Very interesting. Yeah, we'll have to tell the folks where they can go, or is there a website they can go
for
True Delta?
Well, it's truedelta.com. It's TRUEDELTA. And like I said before, because I wanted to get at the real difference between different cars.
That's great. Well, again, thanks so much for having come on. And Peter, always good being good with you, man. Always being good with you. And so we come to another end here, folks. Don't forget that you can follow us at facebook.com/outofline Detroit or at twitter.com/outofline. Get all of Peter's stuff at twitter.com/autoextremist or on Facebook, or just go to AutoExtremist.com. And don't forget that you can subscribe to all of our stuff for free. Just go to our website and look for on the left-hand column where you can click it on and subscribe to our free newsletter that'll keep you up to date with everything that we're doing. And also, don't forget that tomorrow night, starting at 6:30 p.m., Roundabout will be back in the AutoLine studio for the first game of Dungeons and Dealers. But anyway, thanks, folks, for having been with us.
Visit our website, AutoLine.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with AutoLine Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at AutoLine.tv.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.